The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
In celebrity culture, we destroy what we worship. The recent commercial exploitation of Michael Jackson's death was orchestrated by the corporate forces that rendered Jackson insane. Jackson, robbed of his childhood and surrounded by vultures that preyed on his fears and weaknesses, was so consumed by self-loathing, he carved his African-American face into a Caucasian death mask and hid his apparent pedophilia behind a Peter Pan illusion of eternal childhood. He could not disentangle his public and his private self. He became a commodity, a product, one to be sold, used, and manipulated. He was infected by the moral nihilism and personal disintegration that is at the core of our corporate culture. And his fantasies of eternal youth, delusions of majesty and desperate, disfiguring quests for physical transformation were an expression of our own yearning. He was a reflection of us in the extreme. His memorial service, a variety show with a coffin, had an average of 31.1 million television viewers. It was the final episode of the long-running Michael Jackson series. The stories we like best are real life stories, early fame, wild success, and then a long, bizarre, and macabre emotional train wreck. O.J. Simpson offered a tamer version of the same plot. So does Britney Spears. Jackson, by the end, was heavily in debt, had weathered a $22 million out-of-court settlement to Jordy Chandler, as well as 7 counts of child sexual abuse and 2 counts of administering an intoxicating agent in order to commit a felony. He reflected our own physical and psychological disintegration, especially with many Americans struggling with overwhelming debt, loss of status, and personal confusion. The lurid drama of Jackson's personal life meshed perfectly with the ongoing dramas on television, in movies, and the news. News thrives on real-life stories, especially those involving celebrities. News reports on television are mini-dramas, complete with a star, a villain, a supporting cast, a good-looking host, and a dramatic, if often unexpected, ending. The public greedily consumed news about Jackson, especially in his exile and decline, which often outdid fiction. In Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury's novel about a future dystopia, people spend most of the day watching giant television screens that show endless scenes of police chases and criminal apprehensions. Life, Bradbury understood, once it was packaged, scripted, given a narrative and filmed, became the most compelling form of entertainment. And Jackson was a great show. He deserved a great finale. Those who created Jackson's public persona and turned him into a piece of property, first as a child and finally as a corpse encased in a $15,000 golden casket, are the agents, publicists, marketing directors, promoters, script writers, television and movie producers, advertisers, video technicians, photographers, bodyguards, recording executives, wardrobe consultants, fitness trainers, pollsters, public announcers, and television news personalities who create the vast stage of celebrity for profit. They are the puppet masters. No one achieves celebrity status. No cultural illusion is swallowed as reality without these armies of cultural enablers and intermediaries. The producers at the Staples Centers in Los Angeles made sure the 18,000 attendees and television audience and even the BBC devoted 3 hours to the tribute, watched a funeral that was turned into another maudlin form of uplifting popular entertainment. The memorial service for Jackson was a celebration of celebrity. There was the queasy sight of groups of children, including his own, singing over the coffin. Brooke Shields, fighting back tears, recalled how she and a 33-year-old Jackson, who always maintained that he was a straight male, broke into Elizabeth Taylor's room the night before her wedding because Michael was too excited to wait until morning to see the wedding gown. Shields and Jackson at Taylor's wedding then, quote, pretended to be the mother and father of Elizabeth Taylor. It sounds weird, Shields said, but we made it real. There were photo montages in which a shot of Michael Jackson shaking hands with Nelson Mandela was immediately followed by one of him with Kermit the Frog. Celebrity culture reduces all of the famous to the same level. Fame is its own denominator, and every anecdote seemed to confirm that when you spend your life as a celebrity, you have no idea who you are. And yet, we measure our lives by these celebrities. We seek to be like them. We emulate their look and behavior. We escape the messiness of real life through the fantasy of their stardom. We too long to attract admiring audiences for our grand ongoing life movie. We try to see ourselves moving through our life as a camera would see us, mindful of how we hold ourselves, how we dress, what we say. We invent movies that play inside our heads with us as stars. We wonder how an audience would react. Celebrity culture has taught us, almost unconsciously, to generate interior, personal screenplays. We have learned ways of speaking and thinking that grossly disfigure the way we relate to the world and those around us. Neil Gabler, who has written wisely about this, argues that celebrity culture is not a convergence of consumer culture and religion so much as a hostile takeover of religion by consumer culture. Jackson desperately feared growing old. He believed he could control race and gender. He transformed himself through surgery and perhaps female hormones from a brown-skinned African-American male to a chalk-faced, androgynous figure with no clear sexual identity. And while he pushed these boundaries to the extreme, he only did what many Americans do. There were 12 million cosmetic plastic surgery procedures performed last year in the United States. They were performed because in America, most human beings, rich and poor, famous and obscure, have been conditioned to view themselves as marketable commodities. They are objects, like consumer products. They have no intrinsic value. They must look fabulous and live on fabulous sets. They must remain young. They must achieve notoriety and money, or the illusion of it, to be a success. And it does not matter how they get there. The moral nihilism of our culture licenses a dark voyeurism into other people's humiliation, pain, weakness, and betrayal. Education, building community, honesty, transparency, and sharing are qualities that will see you in a gross perversion of democracy and morality, ridiculed and voted off any reality show. Fellow competitors for prize money and a chance for fleeting fame elect to disappear the unwanted. In the final credits of the reality show, America's Next Top Model, a picture of the woman expelled during the episode vanishes from the group portrait on the screen. Those cast aside become, at least to the television audiences, non-persons. Celebrities that can no longer generate publicity, good or bad, vanish. Life, these shows teach, is a brutal world of unadulterated competition and a constant quest for notoriety and attention. And life is about the personal humiliation of those who oppose us. Those who win are the best. Those who lose deserve to be erased. Those who fail, those who are deemed ugly or poor, are belittled and mocked. Human beings are used, betrayed, and discarded in a commodity culture, which is pretty much the story of Jackson's life, although he posthumously experienced the celebrity's equivalent of resurrection. The cult of the self, which Jackson embodied, dominates our culture. This cult has within it the classic traits of psychopaths: superficial charm, grandiosity and self-importance, a need for constant stimulation, a penchant for lying, deception, and manipulation, and the incapacity for remorse or guilt. Jackson, from his phony marriages to the portraits of himself dressed as royalty, to his insatiable hunger for new toys, to his questionable relationships with young boys, had all these qualities. And this is also the ethic promoted by corporations. It is the ethic of unfettered capitalism. It is the misguided belief that personal style and personal advancement, mistaken for individualism, are the same as democratic equality. It is the celebration of image over substance. We have a right in the cult of the self to get whatever we desire. We can do anything, even belittle and destroy those around us, including our friends, to make money, to be happy, and to become famous. Once fame and wealth are achieved, they become their own justification, their own morality. How one gets there is irrelevant. It is this perverted ethic that gave us Wall Street bankers and investment houses that willfully trashed the nation's economy, stole money from tens of millions of small shareholders who had bought stock in these corporations for retirement or college. And the heads of these corporations, like the winners on a reality television program who lied and manipulated others to succeed, walked away with hundreds of millions of dollars in bonuses and compensation. The ethic of Wall Street is the ethic of celebrity. But the tantalizing illusions offered by our consumer culture are vanishing as we barrel towards collapse. The ability of the corporate state to pacify the country by extending credit and providing cheap manufactured goods to the masses is gone. The pernicious idea that democracy lies in the choice between competing brands and the freedom to accumulate vast sums of personal wealth at the expense of others has collapsed. The conflation of freedom with a free market has been exposed as a sham. The travails of the poor are rapidly becoming the travails of the middle class, especially as unemployment insurance runs out and people get a taste of Bill Clinton's draconian welfare reform. In class warfare, once buried under the happy illusion that we were all going to enter an age of prosperity with unfettered capitalism, is returning with a vengeance. American culture, or cultures, for we once had distinct regional cultures, was systematically destroyed in the 20th century by corporations. These corporations used mass communication, as well as an understanding of human psychology, to turn consumption into an inner compulsion. Old values of thrift, regional identity that had its own iconography, aesthetic expression and history, diverse immigrant traditions, self-sufficiency, a press that was decentralized to provide citizens with a voice in their communities, were all destroyed to create mass corporate culture. New desires and habits were implanted by corporate advertisers to replace the old. Individual frustrations and discontents could be solved, corporate culture assured us, through the wonders of consumerism and cultural homogenization. American culture, or cultures, was replaced with junk culture and junk politics. Junk politics does not demand justice or the reparation of rights. Junk politics personalizes and moralizes issues rather than clarifying them. It is impatient with articulated conflict, enthusiastic about America's optimism and moral character, and heavily dependent on feel your pain language and gesture, as Benjamin DeMott noted. The result of junk politics is that nothing changes, meaning zero interruption in the processes and practices that strengthen existing interlocking systems of socioeconomic advantage. Junk politics miniaturizes large, complex problems at home while maximizing threats from abroad. It is also given to abrupt, unexplained reversals of its own public stances, often spectacularly bloating problems previously miniaturized. And finally, it seeks at every turn to obliterate voters' consciousness of socioeconomic and other differences in their midst. And now, standing on the ash heap, we survey the ruins. The very slogans of advertising and mass culture have become the idiom of common expression, robbing us of the language to make sense of the destruction. We confuse the manufactured commodity culture with American culture. How will we cope with our decline? Will we cling to the absurd dreams of a superpower and the fantasies of a glorious tomorrow? Or will we responsibly face our stark new limitations? Will we heed those who are sober and rational, those who speak of a new simplicity and humility? Or will we follow the demagogues and charlatans who rise up in moments of crisis and panic to offer fantastic visions of glory? Will we radically transform our system into one that protects the ordinary citizen and fosters the common good, that defies the corporate state, that dismantles empire? Or will we employ the brutality and technology of our internal security and surveillance apparatus to crush all dissent and drive us into a new dark age? In his book, Democracy Incorporated, Sheldon Wolin, who taught political philosophy at Berkeley and later at Princeton, uses the phrase inverted totalitarianism to describe our political system. Inverted totalitarianism, unlike classical totalitarianism, does not revolve around a demagogue or charismatic leader. It finds expression in the anonymity of the corporate state. It purports to cherish democracy, patriotism, and the Constitution, while manipulating internal levers to subvert and thwart democratic institutions. Political candidates are elected in popular votes by citizens, but they must raise staggering amounts of corporate funds to compete. They are beholden to armies of corporate lobbyists in Washington or state capitals who author the legislation and get the legislators to pass it. A corporate media controls nearly everything we read, watch, or hear. It imposes a bland uniformity of opinion. It diverts us with trivia and celebrity gossip. In classical totalitarian regimes, such as Nazi fascism or Soviet communism, economics was subordinate to politics. Under inverted totalitarianism, the reverse is true, Wolin writes. Economics dominates politics, and with that domination comes different forms of ruthlessness. The Obama brand offers us an image that appears radically individualistic and new. It inoculates us from seeing that the old engines of corporate power and the vast military-industrial complex continue to plunder the country. Brand Obama is about being happy consumers. We are entertained. We feel hopeful. We like our president. We believe he is like us. But like all branded products spun out from the manipulative world of corporate advertising, we are being duped into doing and supporting a lot of things that are not in our interest. What, for all our faith and hope, has the Obama brand given us? His administration has spent, lent, or guaranteed $12.8 trillion in taxpayer dollars to Wall Street and insolvent banks in a doomed effort to reinflate the bubble economy, a tactic that at best forestalls catastrophe and will leave us broke in a time of profound crisis. Brand Obama has allocated nearly $1 trillion in defense-related spending, and the continuation of our doomed imperial project in Iraq, where military planners now estimate that 70,000 troops will remain for the next 15 to 20 years. Brand Obama has expanded the war in Afghanistan, including the use of drones sent on cross-border bombing runs into Pakistan that have left some 700 civilians dead since Obama took office. Brand Obama has refused to ease restrictions so workers can organize, and because of pressure from the for-profit healthcare industry, refuses to consider single-payer, not-for-profit healthcare for all Americans. And Brand Obama will not prosecute the Bush administration for war crimes, including the use of torture, and has refused to dismantle Bush's secrecy laws or restore habeas corpus. Corporations, which control our politics, no longer produce products that are different, but brands that are different. Brand Obama does not threaten the core of the corporate state any more than did brand George W. Bush. The Bush brand collapsed. We became immune to its studied folksiness. We saw through its artifice. And this is a common deflation in the world of advertising. So we have been given a new Obama brand with an exciting and faintly erotic appeal. Benetton and Calvin Klein were the precursors to the Obama brand, using ads to associate themselves with risque style and progressive politics. It gave their products an edge, but the goal, as with all brands, was to fool passive consumers that a brand is an experience. The decline of American empire began long before the current economic meltdown or the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. It began before the first Gulf War or Ronald Reagan. It began when we shifted, in the words of the Harvard historian Charles Mayer, from an empire of production to an empire of consumption. By the end of the Vietnam War, when the costs of the war ate away at Lyndon Johnson's great society, and domestic oil production began its steady, inexorable decline, we saw our country transformed from one that primarily produced to one that primarily consumed. We started borrowing to maintain a lifestyle and an empire we could no longer afford. We began to use force, especially in the Middle East, to feed our insatiable thirst for cheap oil. And the bill is now due. America's most dangerous enemies are not the Islamic radicals, but those who sold us the perverted ideology of free market capitalism and globalization. They have dynamited the very foundations of our society. In the 17th century, these speculators would have been hung. Today, they run the government and consume billions in government subsidies. These corporate forces will never permit real reform. It would mean their extinction. The oil and gas industry will never allow us to achieve energy independence. That would devastate their profits. Real reform would wipe out tens of billions of dollars in weapons contracts. It would cripple the financial health of a host of private contractors, from Lockheed Martin to Boeing to Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Halliburton, Blackwater, now renamed Z. It would render obsolete the existence of the U.S. Central Command. It was Bill Clinton who led the Democratic Party to the corporate watering trough. Clinton argued that the party had to ditch labor unions, no longer a source of votes or power, as a political ally. Workers, he insisted, would vote Democratic anyway. They had no choice. It was better, he argued, to take corporate money and do corporate bidding. By the 1990s, the Democratic Party, under Clinton's leadership, had virtual fundraising parity with the Republicans. Today, the Democrats get more. The legislation demanded by corporations, including the North American Free Trade Agreement, thrust a knife into the back of the American working class. NAFTA was peddled by the Clinton White House as an opportunity to raise the incomes and prosperity of the citizens of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. NAFTA would also, we were told, staunch Mexican immigration into the United States. But NAFTA, which took effect in 1994, had the effect of reversing every one of Clinton's rosy predictions. Once the Mexican government lifted price supports on corn and beans grown by Mexican farmers, those farmers had to compete against the huge agribusinesses in the United States. Many Mexican farmers were swiftly bankrupt. At least 2 million Mexican farmers have been driven off their land since 1994. And guess where many of them went? This desperate flight of poor Mexicans into the United States is now being exacerbated by large-scale factory closures along the border as manufacturers pack up and leave Mexico for the cut-rate embrace of China's totalitarian capitalism. But we were assured that goods would be cheaper, workers would be wealthier, everyone would be happier. I am not sure how these contradictory things were supposed to happen, but in a soundbite society, reality no longer matters. NAFTA was great if you were a corporation. It was a disaster if you were a worker. And we are now getting a taste of Clinton's welfare reform signed in 1996 as millions of people begin to lose their unemployment benefits. Try and live on $143 a month in America. This is Clinton's legacy to the working class. And it was the Clinton administration led by Lawrence Summers which signed into law the Financial Services Modernization Act of 1999, which ripped down the firewalls that had been established by the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, designed to prevent the kind of meltdown we are now experiencing. Glass-Steagall established the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It set in place banking reforms to stop speculators from hijacking the financial system. With Glass-Steagall demolished and the passage of NAFTA, the Democrats, led by Clinton, tumbled gleefully into bed with corporations and Wall Street speculators. And many of the architects of this deregulation, economists such as Summers, have come back to haunt us in the Obama White House. The cost of our empire of illusion is not being paid for by the corporate titans. It is being paid for on the streets of our inner cities, in former manufacturing towns, and in depressed rural enclaves. Human beings are not commodities. They are not goods. They grieve and suffer and feel despair. They raise children and struggle to maintain communities. And the growing class divide is not understood, despite the glibness of many in the media, by complicated sets of statistics, lines on a graph that charts stocks or the absurd utopian faith in unregulated globalization and complicated trade deals. It is understood in the eyes of a man or woman who is no longer making enough money to live with dignity and hope. The growing desperation across the United States is unleashing not simply a recession — we have been in a recession for some time now — but a depression unlike anything we have seen since the 1930s. It has provided a pool of broken people willing to work for low wages and to do without unions or benefits. This is excellent news if you are a corporation. It is very bad news if you are a worker. For the bottom 90% of Americans' annual income has been on a slow, steady decline for three decades. There are 50 million Americans in real poverty and tens of millions of Americans in a category called near poverty. Our elites manipulate statistics and data to foster illusions of growth and prosperity to mask the damage. They refuse to admit they have lost control, since to lose control is to concede failure. They contribute instead to the collective denial of reality by insisting that another multi-billion dollar bailout or government loan will prop up the shattered edifice. And the well-paid television pundits and news celebrities, the economists, and the banking and financial sector leaders see the world from inside the comfort of the corporate box, and they are loyal to the corporate state. The assault on the American working class, an assault that has devastated members of my own family, shows no sign of abatement. In the past 3 years, nearly one in five U.S. workers was laid off. Among workers laid off from full-time work, roughly one-fourth were earning less than $40,000 a year. And there are whole sections of the United States that now resemble the developing world. There has been a Weimarization of the American working class, and the assault on the middle class is underway. Anything that can be put on software, from finance to architecture to engineering, can and is being outsourced to workers in countries such as India or China, who accept pay a fraction of that of their Western counterparts and work without benefits. And both the Republican and Democratic parties, beholden to corporations for money and power, are responsible. Washington has become our Versailles. The media has evolved into a class of courtiers. The Democrats, like the Republicans, are mostly courtiers. Our pundits and experts, at least those with prominent public platforms, are courtiers. We are captivated by the hollow stagecraft of political theater as we are ruthlessly stripped of power. It is smoke and mirrors, tricks and con games, and the purpose behind it is deception. The role of courtiers is to parrot official propaganda. Courtiers do not defy the elite or question the structure of the corporate state, and the corporations in return employ them and promote them as celebrities or elected officials. Courtiers in face powder deceive us in the name of journalism. Courtiers in our political parties promise to look out for our interests and then pass bill after bill to further corporate fraud and abuse. But no class of courtiers, from the eunuchs behind the Manchus in the 19th century to the Baghdad caliphs in the Abbasid caliphate, has ever transformed itself into a responsible and socially productive class. Courtiers are hedonists of power. Being a courtier requires agility and eloquence, and the most talented of them should be credited as persuasive actors. They entertain us. They make us feel good. They persuade us. They are our friends. They are the smiley faces of a corporate state that has hijacked the government. And when the corporations make their iron demands, these courtiers drop to their knees. They placate the telecommunications companies that want to be protected from lawsuits. They permit oil and gas companies to rake in obscene profits and keep in place the vast subsidies of corporate welfare doled out by the state. They allow our profit-driven health care system to leave the uninsured and underinsured to suffer and die. And 20,000 Americans died last year because they could not get proper medical care. Any real discussion of health care should acknowledge the fact that our for-profit health care system is the problem and must be destroyed. Only then can we have an honest debate about what comes next. But this will never happen. It will never happen because the industry's money and lobbyists drive the discussion, and the courtiers in Washington and on television screens dance to the tune they play. America is devolving into a third world nation. And if we do not immediately halt our elite's rapacious looting of the public treasury, we will be left with trillions in debts which can never be repaid, and widespread human misery which we will be helpless to ameliorate. Our anemic democracy will be replaced with a robust national police state. The elite will withdraw into heavily guarded, gated communities where they will have access to security, goods, and services that cannot be afforded by the rest of us. Tens of millions of people, brutally controlled, will live in perpetual poverty, a state of neo-feudalism. This is the inevitable result of unchecked corporate capitalism. The stimulus and bailout plans are not about saving us. They are about saving them. And the lies to employed to camouflage the economic decline have been in place for decades. Ronald Reagan included 1.5 million U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Service personnel with the civilian workforce to magically reduce the nation's unemployment rate by 2%. Clinton decided that those who had given up looking for work, or those who wanted full-time jobs but could only find part-time employment, were no longer to be counted as unemployed. His trick disappeared some 5 million unemployed from the official unemployment rolls. If you work more than 21 hours a week, and most low-wage workers at places like Walmart average 28 hours a week, you are counted as employed, although your real wages put you below the poverty line. Our actual unemployment rate, when you include those who have stopped looking for work and those who can only find poorly paid part-time jobs, is not 9%, but closer to 20%. A sixth of the country is now effectively unemployed, and we are shedding jobs at a faster rate than in the months after the 1929 crash. Franklin Delano Roosevelt recognized the danger of unregulated capitalism. He sent a message to Congress on April 29, 1938, titled Recommendations to the Congress to Curb Monopolies and the Concentration of Economic Power. In it, he wrote, "The first truth is that the liberty of democracy is not safe. If the people tolerate the growth of power to a point where it becomes stronger than the democratic state itself, that, in its essence, is fascism, ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any other controlling private power. The second truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if its business system does not provide employment and produce and distribute goods in such a way to sustain an acceptable standard of living. The rise of the corporate state has grave political consequences, as we saw in Italy and Germany in the early part of the 20th century. Antitrust laws not only regulate and control the marketplace, they also serve as bulwarks to protect democracy. And now that they are gone, now that we have a state run by and on behalf of corporations, we must expect inevitable and, I fear, terrifying consequences. As pressure mounts, as this despair and desperation reach into larger and larger segments of the population, the mechanisms of corporate and government control are being bolstered to prevent civil unrest and instability. The emergence of the corporate state always means the emergence of the security state. And this is why the Bush White House pushed through the Patriot Act and its renewal, the suspension of habeas corpus, the practice of extraordinary rendition, warrantless wiretapping on American citizens, and the refusal to ensure free and fair elections with verifiable ballot counting. It is all part of a package. It comes together. And the motive behind these measures is not to fight terrorism or to bolster national security. It is to seize and maintain internal control, and it is about control of us. Senator Frank Church, as chairman of the Select Committee on Intelligence in 1975, investigated the government's massive and highly secretive National Security Agency. He was alarmed at the ability of the state to intrude into private lives. He wrote, when he finished his investigation, "That capacity at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy left. Such is the capacity to monitor everything. Telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide. If this government ever became a tyranny, if a dictator ever took charge in this country, the technological capacity that the intelligence community has given the government could enable it to impose total tyranny, and there would be no way to fight back. Because the most careful effort to combine together in resistance to the government, no matter how privately it was done, is within the reach of the government to know." When Senator Church made this statement, the NSA was not authorized to spy on American citizens. Today it is. In his book, The Great Transformation, written in 1944, Carl Polanyi, the economist, laid out the devastating consequences, the depressions, wars, and totalitarianism that grow out of a so-called self-regulated free market. He grasped that fascism, like socialism, was rooted in a market society that refused to function. He warned that a financial system always devolved without heavy government control into a mafia capitalism and a mafia political system, which is a pretty good description of our financial structure. All traditional standards and beliefs are shattered in a severe economic crisis. The moral order is turned upside down. The honest and industrious are wiped out, while the gangsters, profiteers, and speculators walk away with millions. A self-regulating market turns human beings and the natural environment into commodities, a situation that ensures the destruction of both society and the natural environment. The free market's assumption that nature and human beings are objects whose worth is determined by the market allows each to be exploited for profit until exhaustion or collapse. A society that no longer recognizes that nature and human life have a sacred dimension, an intrinsic value beyond monetary value, commits collective suicide. Such societies cannibalize themselves until they die. And we face an environmental meltdown that is linked to our economic meltdown. Polar ice caps are melting. Sea levels are rising. The planet is warming at an alarming rate. Droughts are destroying croplands. Russia's northern coastline has begun producing huge quantities of toxic methane gas. Scientists with the International Siberian Shelf Study described what they saw along the coastline recently as methane chimneys reaching from the sea floor to the ocean surface. Methane, locked in the permafrost of Arctic landmasses, is being released at an alarming rate as average Arctic temperatures rise. Methane is a greenhouse gas 25 times more powerful than carbon dioxide, and the release of millions of tons of it will significantly alter the rate of global warming. The continued release of large quantities of methane, some scientists have warned, could actually asphyxiate the human species. But even in the face of this crisis, the oil and natural gas industry, along with the coal industry, have blunted serious reform. Profit comes before the urgent task to save the ecosystem on which human life depends. Our working class, which has desperately borrowed money to stay afloat as real wages have dropped, now face years, maybe decades, of stagnant or declining incomes without access to new credit. The national treasury, meanwhile, is being drained on behalf of speculative commercial interests. The government, the only institutions citizens have that is big enough and powerful enough to protect their rights, is becoming weaker, more anemic, and increasingly unable to help the mass of Americans who are embarking on a period of profound deprivation. We have been borrowing at a rate of more than $2 billion a day over the last 10 years, and at some point, it has to end. The moment China, the oil-rich states, and other international investors stop buying treasury bonds, the dollar will become junk. Inflation will rocket upwards, and we will become Weimar Germany. A furious and sustained backlash by a betrayed and angry populace, one unprepared intellectually and psychologically for collapse, will sweep aside the Democrats and most of the Republicans. It was the economic collapse in Yugoslavia that gave us Slobodan Milosevic. It was the Weimar Republic that vomited up Adolf Hitler. And it was the breakdown in Tsarist Russia that opened the door for Lenin and the Bolsheviks. A cobble of proto-fascist misfits, from Christian demagogues to loudmouth talk show hosts, who we naively dismiss as buffoons, will find a following with promises of revenge and moral renewal. And the elites, the ones with their Harvard Business School degrees, will retreat into their sheltered enclaves of privilege and comfort. There are powerful corporate entities fearful of losing their power and wealth arrayed against us. These anti-democratic forces, which will seek to make an alliance with the radical Christian right and other extremists, will use fear, chaos, the anger at the ruling elite, and the specter of left-wing dissent and terrorism to impose draconian controls to extinguish our democracy. And while they do it, they will be waving the American flag, chanting patriotic slogans, promising law and order, and clutching the Christian cross. Totalitarianism, George Orwell pointed out, is not so much an age of faith, but an age of schizophrenia. A society becomes totalitarian when its structure becomes flagrantly artificial, Orwell wrote. That is when its ruling class has lost its function, but succeeds in clinging to power by force or fraud. And force is soon all the elites will have left. Mass culture assures us that if we close our eyes, if we visualize what we want, if we have faith in ourselves, if we tell God that we believe in miracles, if we tap into our inner strength, if we grasp that we are truly exceptional, if we focus on happiness, our lives will be harmonious and complete. This cultural retreat into illusion, whether peddled by positive psychologists, Hollywood, or Christian preachers, is a form of magical thinking. It turns worthless mortgages and debt into wealth. It turns the destruction of our manufacturing base into an opportunity for growth. It turns alienation and anxiety into a cheerful conformity. It turns a nation that wages illegal wars and administers offshore penal colonies where it openly practices torture into the greatest democracy on earth. It is time to fight back against corporate culture in small and large ways. Coalitions of environmental, anti-nuclear, anti-capitalist, sustainable agriculture, and anti-globalization forces have coalesced in Europe to form and support socialist parties. This has yet to happen in the United States. The left never rallied in significant numbers behind Cynthia McKinney or Ralph Nader, and this was our mistake. In picking the lesser of two evils, it threw its lot in with a Democratic Party that has again proven that it backs our imperial wars, empowers the national security state, and does the bidding of corporations and ignores the needs of citizens. If Obama does not end the flagrant theft of taxpayer dollars by corporations and the disgraceful abandonment of our working class, especially as foreclosures and unemployment mount, many in the country will turn in desperation to the far right, embodied by groups such as Christian radicals. The failure by the left to offer a democratic, socialist alternative, the only alternative remaining that can save our open society, to openly make war on corporate power will mean there will be in the eyes of many embittered and struggling working and middle-class Americans no alternative but a perverted Christian fascism. I spent 2 years traveling the country to write a book on the Christian right called American Fascists, the Christian Right, and the War on America. I visited former manufacturing towns where for many the end of the world is no longer an abstraction. They have lost hope, fear, and instability has plunged much of the working class into profound personal and economic despair, and not surprisingly, into the arms of the demagogues and charlatans of the radical Christian right who offer a belief in magic, miracles, and the fiction of a utopian Christian nation. And unless we rapidly re-enfranchise these dispossessed back into the economy, unless we give them hope, our democracy is doomed. We forget that social reform never comes from accommodating the power structure, but from terrifying it. The Liberal Party, which fought slavery, the suffragists who battled for women's rights, the labor movement, and the civil rights movement knew that the question was not how do we get good people to rule. Most of those attracted to power are at best mediocrities and often venal. But how do we limit the damage the powerful do to us? These mass movements were the engines for social reform, the correctives to our democracy, and the true protectors of the rights of citizens. We must begin to opt out of the mainstream. We must stand behind a viable and uncompromising socialism that is firmly and unequivocally on the side of working men and women. We must no longer be content with the crumbs tossed to us in the vain hope that we can influence the power elite from the inside. We must become as militant as those who are seeking our enslavement. If we remain passive, we will soon be engulfed by a ruthless totalitarian capitalism. If we remain passive as we undergo the largest transference of wealth upwards in American history, we will become serfs. But if we fight back, we have a chance. The saturation coverage of Jackson's death was another example of our collective flight into illusion. It deflected the moral questions arising from mounting social injustice, growing inequalities, costly imperial wars, economic collapse, and political corruption. The wild pursuit of status, wealth, and fame has destroyed our souls, as it destroyed Jackson, and as it has destroyed our economy. The fame of celebrities masks the identities of those who possess true power, corporations, and our oligarchic elite. And as we sink into an economic and political morass, as we barrel towards a crisis that will create misery unseen since the Great Depression, we remain controlled, manipulated, and distracted by the celluloid shadow on the wall of Plato's cave. The fantasy of celebrity culture is not designed simply to entertain. It is designed to drain us emotionally, confuse us about our identity, blame ourselves for our predicament, condition us to chase illusions of fame and happiness, and keep us from fighting back. And in the end, that is all the Jackson coverage was really about. Another tawdry and tasteless spectacle to divert a dying culture from the baying wolf at the gate. Thank you.
is going to be out of time. I'll give you a heads up for one more.
I'll watch the clock.
Okay, good. And then if you would call on people and ask them to wait for the mic.
Okay. Thank you. We have 15 minutes for questions, and there is one microphone or two mics. There's a mic here. So if you have a question, raise your hand and wait. Please wait for the mic. Go ahead. Yeah, right there.
Is it possible to get a copy of your speech?
All of it's in the book except the Jackson stuff. All that happened after the book was published, but the analysis is all there.
Everything you've spoken about begins to sound like us against them, but it's all us. It's all human beings. So how do you get on one side or the other? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it depends which structure
we're
you
all
serve.
Humans.
Well, we're all, of course, but it depends.
It's all a construct of our mind.
Well, all right. I think there are powerful structures, and you know, there's some great political philosophers or moral philosophers like Svetov Todorov who talks about moral fragmentation and the ability. I mean, let's take the for-profit healthcare industry. This is an industry that does not serve the interests of patients. It's listed on the New York Stock Exchange. It serves the interests of shareholders. It quite literally profits off of human misery and death. That doesn't mean that the people who work within it are evil, but Todorov, I think, talks about moral fragmentation, that we have the capacity to work for structures that actually commit evil, but not to see the evil that it commits and define ourselves by our relationship to others and our family. You're certainly right, and I certainly don't mean to dehumanize people who work within CORE. I worked for a Fortune 500 company for 15 years, the New York Times, until they got rid of me over the Iraq War. You're right. But I think there are structures, and we have allowed structures to be created that are strangling us, quite literally. And it's the structures that have to be dismantled. I'm not advocating attacking individuals within those structures, although the head of Lehman Brothers is my vein. Come pretty close.
I just want to encourage you to take this message into an audio format. Joseph Goebbels once said, "We don't need newspapers. The Nazi Party has radio." Talk radio has convinced people I know, including relatives, that Obama is leading us to socialist dictatorship.
Well, we're all
and there are a lot of uninformed people who believe that. If you put this in audio format, it will reach a vastly larger audience.
Well, the problem is that it won't be disseminated. I mean, you know, the reason that right-wing talk radio dominates is because it's commercially more successful. Air America is about to die. And it's driven by, these are profit-driven enterprises. NPR and PBS have, through financing and timidity, become very weak. We still have Moyers and a few people, but so it's hard to disseminate. It's, you know, Wolin's book, which is brilliant. He's 86 years old. He's arguably, I think, probably the greatest living political philosopher in the country. The only paper that reviewed it was the Philadelphia Inquirer, and it's because I wrote the review. I mean, they printed it, but here you have a magnum opus. I mean, it's this guy's life's work, and it's brutal, and it's pretty hard by the time you finish it to argue against it. And so what do? It was shut out. It was just ignored. And so people who challenge structures within the corporate state are really marginalized and pushed. I mean, Kucinich, Nader, even Ron Paul. I'm not a Ron Paul supporter, but he gets it. They're actually even a figure like Jeremiah Wright. What the media does is turns them into figures of ridicule. Wright, I just got an honorary doctorate in Berkeley at a seminary with Wright. I mean, he's a really smart guy, and he certainly understands race and the structure of power. And you know, next question.
Then how do we join a group that will work together and try to change the status quo? What do we?
Well, I think the failing of the left is that we put our faith in the Democratic Party. And you know, that we've just been betrayed and betrayed and betrayed and betrayed. You know, there's still figures, you know, Kucinich would be one who are, you know, it's fascinating to look at the bailout just as a case study. The first bailout, the proposed $700 billion bailout. Constituent calls across the political spectrum were 100 to 1 against the bailout. Some of the most impassioned speeches against the bailout were delivered by right-wing Republicans on the House floor from Texas. Nobody wanted the bailout. It didn't matter where you were placed on the political spectrum, but it passed anyway because the corporations want it. You know, Barney Frank was just asked yesterday, why doesn't anyone promote universal health care for all? And he said it's political suicide. It's political suicide because, unfortunately, we have been undergoing a coup d'etat in slow motion. And unless we reverse that, we are going to face a severe period of economic deprivation. I mean, we're trying to borrow our way back to a bubble economy. And so that when everything falls through, we're not going to have the resources. I mean, you know, imagine if these resources had gone into rebuilding infrastructure and creating jobs and putting people back to work and giving health care. I mean, health care is good for businesses because it reduces the cost that businesses have to spend. I mean, we took a system of managed capitalism, which worked pretty well, and we allowed these people to destroy it. Let's get in the back. Why don't you get someone in the back there? Sheldon Wolin, he wrote his new book is Democracy Incorporated. W-O-L-I-N. Go ahead. And just grab anybody. I'm easy.
Chris, I've been thinking for the last couple of weeks about trying to come up with a word to describe the advertising campaigns for certain sports figures. The word that I finally came up with was messianic. The advertising campaign for LeBron James says something like, "We are all witnesses." I was wondering if you kind of see that, like the fetishism of sports figures and the incredible salaries and things like that, as part of this phenomenon.
Yeah, because in a celebrity culture, you live out your life in the idealized version of the celebrity. And, of course, now sports figures are very much part of the celebrity culture. And they weren't before the rise of modern advertising after World War I. They were sort of that is a relatively new creation. But they serve the same kind of function that celebrities serve.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much. This is one of the best things I've heard at the library, and I'm here a lot. I work in the wedding industry, and it tries to create fantasy and materialism and largely succeeds with young people. And I realize that a lot of my clients were born after Reagan was president, so they don't have the depth of knowledge that I do that something else could exist. And I see this as a real problem for the next generation. Do you share that concern?
Yeah, I mean, when I wrote the book, I went back and read a lot of people who wrote in the 50s. The Power Elite, David Reisman's The Lonely Crowd, that Hogarth's book on the uses of literacy. And I think the reason, I mean, they're all brilliant people, but I think the reason they were particularly prescient is that they still remembered what we'd lost. They were, you know, they were, most of them were middle-aged. I mean, you know, the wedding industry is a classic example. You know, people didn't used to give diamond rings, as you probably know, when you got married. That was totally created by Hollywood, courtesy of, what's the big diamond maker, DeVore's or De Beers, you know, who pitched it. You know, I mean, the power. Neil Gabler wrote a book called Life, the Movie, that's pretty sharp on this stuff. As Neil Borstein's The Image, Pseudo-Event America, both I think are pretty smart on this kind of stuff to see how we've been conditioned. And that's Hogarth's book as well. He's British, and he studied the British working class and what mass culture did to the values of the working class. He wrote that book right after World War I, again, 51 or something. And And they make the point, which I think is true, and I tried just briefly made it here, that by disseminating mass culture, you were destroying something. You were instilling another kind of value system. I mean, what is, I mean, I write about reality shows, and I have a chapter on the porn industry, and I just went to professional wrestling bouts, which were fascinating, because the narratives have changed in professional wrestling. It used to be you were fighting the Russian bear or the Iron Sheik or whatever. Now it's all about disintegrating families and sibling rivalries and everyone cheats. And it's a perfect example of a complete collapse of the value system. Popular culture reflects that really well. Let's get someone like up there. No, but wait for the microphone.
Mr. Hedges, thank you for a beautifully cynical evening. Today I dealt with just ordinary events of life and came across 10 huge corporations in very ordinary living. I took an elevator down, and that was made by United Technologies, a Fortune 500 company. Then I took a bus, and parts of it were made by GE or Delphi or GM. And then I went to the courthouse and saw electricity and air conditioning, and part of it was made by GE or Philadelphia Electric Company, both of them Fortune 500 companies. And then this evening when I turned on the TV, I had to reach through Comcast, another happy experience through Fortune 500, and I turned on the computer and dealt with Microsoft. I also made and received some phone calls through Verizon. These are all happy experiences, and my question to you is, why are you so desperately negative about the corporations and America? And if you are that negative, do you still see something great about America? Tell me 7 things you see great. And if you don't, why is it that the rest of the world wants to come here rather than the other way around? Thank you.
Well, first of all, a lot of immigrants are going back because they can't survive here, including Mexicans. That's number one. And number two, the attributes of a consumer or commodity culture give you things for a price. And when you are no longer able to pay that price, when you can't pay your mortgage, you're thrown out on the street. There is a rapacious cruelty to unfettered capitalism. Look, just as a small example, what we do to our mentally ill. Our mentally ill are tossed out on sidewalks, 25%. We have, of course, the largest percentage of prisoners in the industrialized world, 25% of the world's prisoners, although we're only 2.2% of the industrial world's population, and 25% of them are mentally ill. We live in a resegregated society. I live in New Jersey, probably one of the most segregated states in the United States. If you're born in Camden or parts of Jersey City or Newark or Trenton, you have no chance. What we have created is an oligarchic system where the top 1% now control more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. And you cannot sustain a democracy in an oligarchy, and you can go back and read Thucydides and Plutarch, who understood this. This isn't a new understanding. And if we don't break that oligarchic grip, what did make America, I think, a beacon to much of the rest of the world was the fact that we treated our working class well. They had benefits, they had health care, they had unions, they could earn wages of $50 an hour. They've been decimated, and we have stood by and done nothing. And we're going to pay a price for it. We are paying a price for it. Let's get in the way back. Go ahead. Wait for the mic, please. And we're going to stop at quarter of. That's what they've asked me to do, so make it quick.
It's a terrific lecture, and I wanted to ask what you think about the prospect of a truth process here. I think that there are, as the woman said in the front, there are different perceptions. There are different memories. There's a role of memory here. And the question is whether we could have a truth process. There are people who remember Martin Luther King, when Martin Luther King walked the earth, and Robert F. Kennedy, and there were different dreams. And the paradigms in this country have shifted. The goals, the dreams, the visions that we pursue are very, very different now. And so what young people are reaching for is very different than maybe my generation reached for. So if consent, I mean, if truth is essential to consent, and the legitimate governments get their legitimacy from the consent of the people, don't we need a truth process so that people can be informed about the government that they have and to give this country again its legitimacy?
That touches on, you know, the core of the book, because a society that can no longer distinguish between reality and illusion dies. Image-based cultures are by nature totalitarian cultures. The more we sever ourselves from print, the more we confuse these images, which are skillfully done, the more we confuse how we're made to feel with knowledge. You know, the more we confuse propaganda with ideology, the blinder we become. And you can see the effects all around it. Newspapers are hanging on by their fingertips, including the Inquirer. The publishing industry is in crisis. I just came from San Francisco. The two largest independent bookstores, Cody and BlackRock, have closed. All of these are symptomatic. 80% of American households last year didn't buy a book. And when you fall into that warm embrace, you know, and we are a society utterly awash in lies. When you watch that commercial of the Canadian woman talking about how, you know, you should protect your rights, don't let them socialize your medicine, it becomes very hard to argue because people speak in what Robert J. Lifton called thought-terminating cliches. But I have hope. I mean, we have seen great figures and great moments, great movements arise out of this country. Some of them I mentioned in my talk. And, you know, that's why I talk about forget about power, formal power. You know, the last liberal president we had was Nixon, not because he was a liberal, but because he was terrified of liberals. That's how we got OSHA. That's how we got the Mine and Safety Act. That's how we got a host of bills pushed through and because there was a pushback, and we need to build that. I'm just going to end with a poem by Langston Hughes before we go. It's called Let America Be America Again. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain seeking a home where he himself is free. America never was America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great, strong land of love, where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme that any man be crushed by one above. It never was America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery's scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I am the young man full of strength and hope tangled in that ancient endless chain of profit, power, gain, of grab the land, of grab the gold, of grab the ways of satisfying need, of work the men, of take the pay, of owning everything for one's own greed. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker, sold to the machine. I am the Negro, servant to you all. I am the people, humble, hungry, mean. Hungry, yet today, despite the dream, beaten, yet today, O pioneers, I am the man who never got ahead, the poorest worker bartered through the years. Yet I'm the one who dreamt our basic dream in the old world while still a serf of kings, who dreamt a dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet its mighty daring sings in every brick and stone, in every furrow turned that's made America the land it has become. Oh, I'm the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home. For I'm the one who left dark Ireland's shore and Poland's plain and England's grassy lea, and torn from black Africa's strand, I came to build a homeland of the free. The free? Who said the free? Not me. Surely not me. The millions on relief today, the millions shot down when we strike, the millions who have nothing for our pay. For all the dreams we've dreamed and all the songs we've sung and all the hopes we've held and all the flags we've hung, the millions who have nothing for our pay except the dream that's almost dead today. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet and yet must be, the land where every man is free, the land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose, the steel of freedom does not stain. For those who live like leeches on the people's lives, we must take back our land again, America. Oh, yes, I say it plain, America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft and stealth and lies, we, the people, must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plain, all that stretch of these great green states, and make America again. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.